And now we're going to turn to David Swanson. David, are you there?
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Hi.
And you're listening to The Surreal News on WSLR 96.5 Low Power FM in Sarasota, your community radio station. My co-host is Larry, who's going to read your bio in a minute. And also, you're going to be coming to town in a couple weeks to join us at Books A Million for a book signing. We'll talk about that. But first, Larry wants to introduce you.
Good morning, David. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
David Swanson is the author of the new best-selling book, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union by Seven Stories Press. And he's also the author of the introduction to, quote, the 35 Articles of Impeachment and the Case for Prosecuting George W. Bush, published by Farrell House and available at Amazon. Swanson holds a master's degree in philosophy from the University of Virginia. He's worked as a newspaper reporter and as a communications director with jobs including press secretary for Denis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign. He was media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association and 3 years as communications coordination for ACORN. God, they could use you now, David.
I don't know if I could have prevented all of this mess.
Oh, man. Woof. The ACORN, of course, the Association for Community Organizations for Reform Now, very much in the press, and the conservatives have blood on their teeth after going after their neck. Swanson, David is a co-founder of the AfterDowningStreet.org, creator of ConvictBushCheney.org, and Washington Director of Democrats.com, a board member of Progressive Democrats of America and the Backbone Campaign of Voters for Peace. David, how do you get time to have breakfast? That's a lot of stuff.
I have a 3-year-old who gets up at 5 in the morning. I have plenty of time to eat breakfast.
That should balance your life out.
All right, so David, the general premise of your book, and it's a very good read. You're a very good writer. I enjoyed it. Is
Thank
that...
you.
Our Constitution sets out certain powers with balance of powers and decides with Congress and the executive branch and the courts, and that this has been upset in some way, correct?
Very much so, practically reversed, inverted from what it is in the Constitution. You know, Article 1 is the first branch of our government, the Congress, takes up about the first 60% of the Constitution, provides virtually all the powers in our government to the Congress. Article 2, very short, is about a rather weak executive who is supposed to execute the will of the Congress and faithfully execute the laws as written and passed by the Congress, also to serve as commander-in-chief in time of war as determined by Congress when Congress says there should be a war and raises and oversees an army for that war. That's the extent of the presidential powers. Congress is supposed to have the power to raise and spend every dime, to make every law, to ratify treaties and appointments, to handle all of financial issues in the nation. And we now are in a situation where presidents can make laws with signing statements, with executive orders, with secret memos, legalizing crimes like torture. Presidents can make wars. They can spend money that they take unconstitutionally from other places and begin wars in secret with no consequences. They can make treaties without the ratification of the Senate to do such things as extend wars for 3 more years in places like Iraq. Presidents have virtually unlimited powers. And Congress is still there, and Congress does a lot of chitter-chattering, but none of what it says has any teeth anymore because it's voluntarily given up the two powers it had that gave any teeth to anything, the primary one being impeachment, the other one being the power of subpoena, which is something Congress can enforce, but now it asks the Justice Department to enforce its subpoenas, and lately, knowing that the Justice Department won't, it just doesn't subpoena anyone. So Congress has become sort of a court of advisors or jesters, and the president is thought of, for better or worse, by most people across the spectrum, as our government.
And you think that our founding fathers would probably be shaking if they saw what was going on, and in your book you said, you know, we broke away from England because the king is law, and we tried to establish a country where law is king, correct?
Thomas Paine said that. I just quoted it. John Adams said we are going to be a nation of laws, not a nation of men. This has been the American tradition. This was actually innovative and courageous 225 years ago. What has held our republic together, but we are losing it, rapidly losing it. We are to some extent focused on what the damage has been. We've turned against these destructive wars. We want to shift our resources to health care and other human needs, but we're not focused enough on the structural damage that has given so much power to the presidency, and the danger in leaving those powers there for the current president and every future one. We're to the point where you'll hear progressives who claim to care about the rule of law advocating that President Obama simply give us good health care with an executive order, or
right,
signing statement in single-payer health care. Yeah. Incredibly self-defeating, destructive way of thinking.
Well, I was actually on this soapbox before the program as we were talking about your visit here and saying, it seems to me, and I'd be really interested in your comment on this, that Obama has been trying to do, to be a constitutional president, as you're describing it. He's obviously trying to let Congress come up with a health reform. There was a long article in the New Yorker recently by Jeffrey Toobin analyzing Obama's view of the Supreme Court, in which he concludes that Obama agrees the Supreme Court should never be a source for setting public policy or any political direction, and is really considering it kind of a marginal institution, and trying to get grassroots democracy started again with bipartisanship. And it seems to me the left is more annoyed with him than the right, wanting him to do exactly what you're saying, is use the imperial presidency now that, quote, we've got it.
Yeah, I mean, many on the left had outrageous expectations of him personally, given who he is, and
Rachel
of a president.
Rachel Maddow being, I think, the number one kind of example of this.
Yes, I don't watch every show, but I have seen some of that from her. I think you know, you have these outrageous expectations of what an election can do, what a president can do, what a president should be able to do, and then you're outrageously disappointed. I skipped both of those phases. I think we ought to move beyond that. We've never seen a president before in the history of our country come in and give up powers. We aren't going to see much of that from this one. There is the possibility of Congress coming in and taking back its powers if we compel it to. I mean, Barack Obama knows the Constitution. He's taught the Constitution. He knows exactly what to say. He can stand in front of the Constitution in the National Archives and throw habeas corpus out the window and sound like he's defending our sacred documents. And, you know, it's hard to say he's as bad as Bush in this regard, but as Cindy Sheehan has said, you know, she's got a corn on her foot that's better than Bush. That's a very low hurdle to clear. So here we have a president who comes in and says, well, I'm only going to issue signing statements if I really, really have to. And I'm going to let you see the White House visitor logs, not the ones in the past months that you want to see with the healthcare executives, but ones in the future that I decide are not relevant to national security. I'll let you see those ones. And I'm only going to shout state secrets to shut down entire cases, not just to block a piece of information, as Bush and Cheney tried, only after my lawyers thoroughly approve it. I mean, all of these reforms sound very good, and everybody declares, oh, finally something good. And yet, when you look carefully for a couple of days, you realize that none of these reforms transfer a bit of power to any branch other than the executive. I mean, we learned in elementary school about the three different branches, and now we think about the two different parties, and we're completely lost
as
to what's going on.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so talk to us about how politics was supposed to be part of the government in the past, and then how it's transformed over the past 8 years.
Well, as I mentioned, all kinds of powers have moved to the White House, and Congress has voluntarily been complicit in that. It has passed laws to give retroactive immunity to criminals, as the Military Commissions Act, the Detainee Treatment Act, all of these laws to legalize crimes. But in most cases, it's been sins of omission. It's been standing by and announcing, we won't impeach you no matter what you do. We won't enforce subpoenas. If you guys don't want to show up, don't show up. And so it's been one branch of government seizing powers and the other branch saying, here, take them, take some more. And the problem is that Congress members don't have any loyalty to Congress as a branch of government. At any given moment, roughly half of Congress has loyalty to the executive because he's the leader of their party, and it's all about party now. And the other half is loyal to their party's leadership in the Congress, which is usually a very bad thing, certainly has been in recent years for either of the two parties we're dealing with. So the question is, can we compel the Congress to do better? We saw a bill introduced yesterday by 22 Congress members to say, we will not fund an escalation in Afghanistan. That's exactly right. This is not a debate between a president and the military. This is a question for Congress. But we saw a Republican senator, John McCain, suggest bringing the top general, Stan McChrystal, in to testify, and the Democrats running scared from that. No, we don't want him to come in and testify because he would just say the same stuff he's already been saying in public about how we need to escalate. No, what cowardice, what incredible failure to execute their duty to bring in war commanders and question them about what in their world they're doing and whether it should be funded or not.
So one of my takes on this, just as a sort of a side point, is that we have loyalty to the party, and it could be Democrat or Republican Party, versus loyalty to the American people, and also just doing sort of the will of the people versus the will of the party. And could you talk about some of the motivations for the party versus motivation for somebody that might want to, like, help the American people?
Well, my congressional district, Virginia's 5th, we just elected one of the worst Democrats in the House, but he was miles above the guy we got rid of, who was one of the worst Republicans in the House. So everybody was happy. Things have changed. But he won by a fraction of a percentage point. It took months to count it. And he had been given over $1 million in the last weeks by the National Democratic Party in Washington. That's where his loyalty now lies. So back in June, we had a vote on whether to fund these wars and to give a massive banker bailout to Eastern European bankers through the IMF. And he was gung-ho for the war, of course, but he didn't want to give money to the IMF for all the wrong reasons. He didn't want to. And his constituents didn't want him to, didn't want him to back either of those things. And he wasn't going to. But the Democratic leadership said, do you want to have $1 million next time around? Or do you want us to back someone against you in the next primary? Do you want us to push your bills forward and back your earmarks and do some press events with you in your district? We'll send Steny Hoyer down there, put you on the front page. We'll send cabinet officials and Van Jones, before he was fired, down there. And so my congressmember voted against his constituents and for the leadership of his party, and then had all these bogus PR events with White House staff in his district to put him on the front page of the newspapers without announcing any particular news. And that's what Congress members are up against. And a lot of that corruption is money. If we were to clean up the financing system, it would drastically limit the power of the parties. But it wouldn't do anything about chairmanships and bills and earmarks and other threats and bribes. It wouldn't do anything about the ballot access limitations that mean only the two parties can compete. And it wouldn't do anything about the bipartisan agreed upon gerrymandering that give these people almost permanent seats. So we have a lot of cleaning up to do, and our ideal, I'm afraid, should not be what people think it should be. People think, oh, if the Democrats had more party discipline, they could ram through at least a halfway good health care bill. But if the Democrats had good party discipline, there would be no opposition to wars in Congress. There would be no support for majority American position on almost any issue, because the Democratic leadership opposes it. So I don't want party discipline even for the better of the two parties or even for a third or fourth party. I want loyalty to constituents.
Okay. Well, we need to say this is WSLR, Low Power FM, 96.5 in Sarasota, and our guest is David Swanson. And we are talking about Limits of Power on the Imperial Presidency, his new book. Yes, Steve?
Yeah. So just as a follow-up to that, I want to read you a quote from Dick Cheney and set this up for us. So?
As Dick Cheney
that quote, Dick Cheney. So,
yes.
All right. So, what was that all about?
This was something I discussed in the early parts of the book. Dick Cheney was asked whether he cared that a strong majority of Americans wanted out of Iraq, and he said so. And the television interviewer asked him, "Don't you care that the majority of Americans?" He said, no. I won't be swayed by opinion polls. And you will hear that from all politicians across the political spectrum. I will stand by my principles and not be swayed by opinion polls. Excuse me. Opinion polls, often inaccurate, often dishonest, still are, for the most part, a measure of where the public is. You know, and before this most recent election, we didn't have a majority against the war in Afghanistan. Now we do. Do we want our politicians to say, well, I'm going to stand by where you all were when I was elected last November, or I'm going to support where you are now? And if we want them to support where we are now, then we have to start thinking about how we influence these people in between elections and stop thinking about public opinion as one of the corrupting forces. You know, our elections have been so corrupted by the money and the corporate media and the gerrymandering and all the rest of it that we almost think of elections as a corrupting force, and we want these independent principled aristocrats to ignore us. People applaud Dick Cheney when he tells them he's going to ignore them. No, that's not the way to think. The way to think is, can we clean up our elections, and more importantly, can we apply public pressure in between elections so that they actually are concerned about what we think.
I guess my one comment on what you're saying is that the process today is different than it was when I first started going into politics. JFK was the first president that was on the ballot when I started voting at age 21, and those were the days of LBJ and Tip O'Neill after that, and Everett Dirksen for the Republicans. And I honestly can't see that the situation now is any different than it was then, that it would have been not the Democratic Party calling your worst Democratic representative in the House. It would have been LBJ calling your worst Democratic congressman in the House and telling him to get his buns out there and vote a particular way, or he won't have any street lights or roads or highways or anything else. So I'm not sure that you're not hearkening back to a time when actually your idealism was actually in effect. It's just that it's a different group of people who are controlling these pawns in Congress than they were before, and to probably not a very much different outcome, it seems to me.
Well, that basic problem of party discipline and of the president's influence on Congress members through putting military contracts in their districts and so forth is not brand new. The extent of the money involved is new. Political so-called contributions have been going up at thousands of times the rate of inflation, faster than the housing market, faster than anything. We are going to be, at this pace, we're going to be talking about billions pretty soon for campaign financing, and that's going to happen almost immediately if the Supreme Court rules a particular way on a case that's before it right now.
We know that. County commissioner race here in a county of 250,000 to 300,000 people costs $250,000. Go figure.
And,
well, I agree with that.
And the president, not just this particular president, but any of them, take tens of times what any senator takes. And the senators typically, especially in large states, take many times what the House members take, which is one of the reasons. There are several others. Why, if we're going to influence anybody, it's most likely going to be our House members. And what is new is that our House members don't want to have any power. Tip O'Neill worked very, very hard to hold Richard Nixon accountable for his crimes and drove him out of town by maneuvering to an impeachment that was bound to pass, and he jumped on a helicopter and fled. The Congress then passed legislation, including the FISA bill and the war crimes, the War Powers Act, and steps intended, at least, to restrain presidential power. And when the Democrats did that, incidentally, they won the biggest victories that anybody can remember. And so there is a popular support, and is still in opinion polls, for Congress standing up against the presidency, even a popular president, and taking back power and fighting for the rule of law. But our House members don't want to do it now, and that is different from Tip O'Neill.
All right, there's a quote from your book, and I want you to continue on with what we're talking about here. Accountability is not about looking backward, it's about looking forward. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you or I go out and bust store windows and steal stuff and the cops show up, we can't say, oh, but officer, please look forward. That's in the past now. Don't look backward. This is not retribution. This is a time for reconciliation, officer. Do you want to hurt the morale of window breakers? Do you want to endanger national security? You know, we can't talk utter nonsense because we don't have the power to put it on television tens of thousands of times to the point where people forget that it's utter nonsense. But Dick Cheney can. And so we hear that it would be looking backward to prosecute high officials for their crimes, including the authorization of torture, which our former president and vice president confessed to openly on television. But, you know, excuse me, every single crime is in the past. Only in sci-fi Tom Cruise movies do you prosecute crimes in the future. You don't do that in the real world. If you're going to deter crimes, you're going to prosecute them. If you're going to treat them as policy differences and say, well, at the moment we're going to have the policy of not torturing, but we'll decide to have the policy of torturing if we choose to, and so it's not a crime anymore, then torture continues, as it is continuing right this moment. So it's not about punishing some individuals that we don't like. It's not about revenge. Revenge is this destructive way of thinking that let them take us into these wars. It's about deterring crimes in the future.
And I guess this sort of goes back to the rule of law, and I'm going to let Larry talk for a minute because I know he has a slightly different opinion of this, and Larry and I have slightly different opinions, but I think what you're saying is just apply the law equally to everybody, get politics out of it, and if we don't apply the law, then we're really setting ourselves up for a repeat of the same crimes. Is that right?
Repeat, and it's not just theoretical anymore. It's ongoing. These illegal aggressive wars are ongoing and being expanded. We have indefinite detention with no habeas corpus and no Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendments. We have prisoners in Bagram and Guantanamo. We have a president and a CIA that continue to assert the right to torture, although they claim not to be using it. They claim the right to render people to other nations where they might be tortured. Our current president would be behaving very differently if Bush and Cheney had been impeached or if they were about to be prosecuted. So it's not just about future presidents, although we can imagine future presidents taking it to far more dangerous points.
Steve referred to he and I having a little bit different point of view on this. I'm not so much a principled thinker on this particular point, but more pragmatic. I think that going after the CIA is a little bit of a diversionary tactic. To me, it's the Bush administration and now the Obama administration getting in bed with the Pentagon and the military, and all 90% of intelligence being gathered through the Pentagon and only about 10% of it being gathered through the CIA. And so while I agree that the torture issue and Guantanamo and all of those abuses were primarily through CIA, or so we think, that a lot of it is through mercenaries hired by the Pentagon, and I'm just really very, very concerned about how cozy the Obama administration is, although, you know, there's no anybody like Rumsfeld who's, you know, as loathsome. Nobody's as loathsome as Rumsfeld is to maybe suggest that anything bad is happening there. So I'm just concerned that we're looking under the streetlight for the lost wallet, because that's where the light's better. It's just,
well, I couldn't agree more. In terms of the scale of things, torture is, you know, getting anybody, even Bush and Cheney, on torture is like getting Al Capone on tax fraud. These people slaughtered 1.3 million Iraqis,
right,
and ruined,
right,
the country and drove millions of people out of their homes. And this was run out of the Pentagon. And the intelligence operation run by Doug Feith out of the Pentagon unconstitutionally helped drive that. But this is all one happy family. Gates is a former CIA
guy.
This is a permanent bureaucracy of a military, industrial, intelligence, congressional, media complex that is driving this agenda still. And we have all of these former CIA directors, many of whom have also worked at the Pentagon,
exactly,
coming out and saying, don't you dare prosecute the CIA for its crimes.
It would be so bad for their morale. Listen, I just have, I mean, as you're talking, this is, I wish we could talk forever here. I'm curious, if you put the principle aside, the constitutional issues, I mean, which are, I know you can't, we can't, but would you rather have the existing Congress, Senate and White House, the Senate and House representatives, fulfilling their constitutional role as they are presently constituted, or would you rather have an imperial Obama?
I would rather have the Congress, because one of the major corrupting forces on the Congress is Barack Obama. They have been, although he has, to his credit, allowed them to write a health care bill, he has walked them step by step through the destructive course of it. He has told the committee chairmen to try to block single payer. He cut the deal with the progressives in the House to make their opening bid for a public option not single payer. He has told Senator Baucus how to destroy things every step of the way. This is not a well-kept secret. We have to sort of stop fantasizing about any benevolent dictator, but this one in particular, because his goals are not any better than Congress's, and he is himself a corrupting influence on Congress. But were that not the case, and did I suspect that the world might continue longer than 3 years, I would not want a benevolent dictator running things, because that would be luck. That would be chance. We have no influence over him in between elections, and the next benevolent dictator could decide not to be benevolent anymore and undo everything. We have no control over a guy who can ignore whole regions of the country, isn't up for 4 years, gets 10 times the money, is the focus of the corporate media's corrupting influence night and day, and you can't get to him because of a Secret Service. I mean, we have no control over that guy. And if he were doing good things, it would be luck. And so I don't want that, and it's incredibly self-defeating and diversionary for people to be fantasizing about it, because we have to forget about it and focus on the House of Representatives and put our energies there, because we have a chance.
All right, speaking of luck, we are so lucky to be speaking with David Swanson, and if you like what you're hearing here, David, you're going to be coming to town right here to Sarasota on Tuesday, October 13th, to discuss the new book that we're talking about, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, and that's at Books A Million, 2 o'clock on Tuesday, October 13th at 6591 South Tamiami Trail. So we're looking forward to having you come to town, and we encourage everybody on October 13th to join you and see you in person, and if they buy your book, you'll sign it, right?
Absolutely. I very much appreciate that. I'm looking forward to coming down to sunny Florida.
It's beautiful here. Beautiful here. David, this has been a great conversation. I really, really appreciate the time that you're spending.
All right, so it's something I'm just dying to ask you about, because you're a media person, you're a press person. What about the media's role in this?
The media is the number one excuse you get from Congress members and staffers when you ask them to do something that the majority of the public wants. No, 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 the media would attack us. You know, here we have a House Judiciary Committee that impeached a judge from Texas this year for groping people, and there's a judge sitting out there on the Ninth Circuit with a permanent lifetime seat who's the chief official who put together these torture memos and a memo legalizing aggressive war, Jay Bibee. And Senator Leahy asks him, would you mind coming in? And he says, no, I don't feel like it, and that's that. And they won't, John Conyers won't consider impeaching him because then John Conyers might be accused of going after a conservative judge. Never mind that he legalized torture. Never mind that there is the most blatant, literally down in black and white, reason for impeaching the guy. No, because the media might accuse me of going after a conservative judge. Well, he wouldn't impeach Bush or Cheney. Let them do a full 8 years, all the damage they could do, because the media might have accused him of going after a president in a time of war. The media is the single most destructive force, worse than the money, although they are interlocking. Has to be cleaned up, and that means in the long run busting the monopolies, which are essentially a cartel now. It means opening up public and independent and community media. In the short run, it means supporting good media outlets like this one and ceasing to go and buy full page ads in the New York Times, without which we wouldn't have this war.
So it sounds like you're blaming partly the media for their attacks and also partly Congress for listening to them. And we did report it. Here's some late-breaking news. That it looks like Comcast might be buying NBC.
From General Electric?
Yeah, that was reported on NPR this morning.
Yeah.
Of course, Comcast being the ones that want to censor everything as that goes into their internet to their internet audience, I guess you'd have to say.
Yeah, when we launched after DowningStreet.org 5 years ago to publicize the Downing Street Minutes and flooded media outlets with phone calls until they couldn't work until they printed it, Comcast blocked all emails that included after DowningStreet.org, the name of our website. You couldn't receive
them. Let's go there, because I wanted to go there. I wanted to talk about what the Downing Street memos were. This was reported in England. It was reported virtually not at all here. We had Greg Pallast on our show, who was involved with some of the early reporting of that, a BBC reporter. Are you familiar with Greg Pallast?
Sure, of course.
Yeah,
he's done a lot of election reporting in Florida as well.
Yes, yeah, so he's been on our show several times. So walk us through a little bit of that. You know, we like to do sort of media misinformation and media roles and stuff there, but talk to us through about what happened with the Downing Street memos that you were involved with.
Well, the unusual thing was that this was a story the U.S. media wouldn't cover, although the rest of the world's media was all over it, and you had editorials saying, leave us alone, we won't cover it, and then within a week, big front page articles, and this is major U.S. newspapers. You had television networks refuse to talk about it and then mention the famous Downing Street Minutes in their first ever mention of the thing, which of course was not famous to their viewers, and you had these reversals because of the public flooding these offices with phone calls, emails, lobby protests, and the sheer volume and passion of the American public for forcing the thing into the U.S. media changed it. It sort of overruled the decision of the U.S. media, at least for some weeks. And this was in May of 2005, and the key document was, of course, the minutes of an official meeting in England where the head of intelligence for the UK was telling Tony Blair and gang about his day-long meeting the previous day with the head of U.S. intelligence, George Tenet. And he was saying that the U.S. was going to go to war in Iraq regardless, knew Iraq was not a threat to anybody, was going to lie about the weapons and ties to 9/11 in order to make the case, was willing to go to the United Nations, but if the United Nations said no, this is not legal, was going to go ahead with the war anyway, and so forth. And of course, for
and the intelligence was fixed, right?
Going to fix the facts around the policy was the key phrase, that the policy being going to war in Iraq, and the facts being it made clear that they knew Iraq didn't have these weapons and wasn't a threat even to its neighbors and so on. And so this at this point in time, in May of 05, when this came out, this was far and away the most authoritative piece of evidence we had for what many of us knew all along, which was that we were lied into a war. It's not clear that we actually needed any evidence. The lies were practically open lies. They were so absurd. But this was a moment in time when the Democrats were in the minority and behaved as if they wanted to end the wars and impeach the architects of the wars. And they held unofficial minority hearings with us and began talking about impeachment. And so the public was energized. And over the next months and years, many more powerful pieces of evidence came out than this one. I wouldn't put it in the top 10 anymore, but gradually the public lost faith that it made any difference, that the Congress was going to do anything, that having more facts was what was needed. It became obvious that having more willpower or public control of our so-called representatives was what was needed. So it was a unique moment in May of 05 when this happened.
You were part of the impeachment movement for impeach Cheney, et cetera. And now that Cheney and Bush are out of power, what about still holding them accountable? And there was a news item report, I'm flipping through my notes to see a reference here, saying that Wu and Ashcroft might be able to be prosecuted.
Well, there's been some good rulings related to John Yoo and John Ashcroft in regard to civil suits and to the effect that some of the victims of their policies can sue them for damages, despite the fact that these are crimes for which they remain unindicted. There was a good piece of news with regard to Dick Cheney yesterday, which was that a court of law ordered the FBI, the Justice Department, to release the transcript of Cheney's interviews with the FBI about the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity. This was the leaking of the identity of an undercover CIA agent, which it is very clear already from the evidence was orchestrated by Dick Cheney, but it's possible that having his interview made public would compel the Justice Department to take action. We'll see. Absolutely, we have to hold Bush and Cheney accountable. It's once they're out of office that it becomes easier to prosecute them for their crimes. That needs to be done. They are confessing to some of their crimes on television. The question is, how do we make it happen? Because the Justice Department has already announced that they want to give immunity to all high officials and want to simply go after certain bad apple, low-ranking people as a token statement on behalf of the rule of law. So what do we do? I think we have to pressure the Justice Department more firmly than ever. We have to pressure Congress to subpoena these people. Congress has the power to subpoena Dick Cheney, Jay Bybee, John Ashcroft, any of them, bring them in and force them to testify, which would have the additional, even more important consequence of re-empowering the Congress. Subpoenaing and enforcing its own subpoenas or impeaching anybody, the biggest reason to do those things is to reconstitute the Congress as a branch in our government. There are civil suits that can be pursued. There are foreign suits and international possibilities that can be pursued. There are local and state angles for prosecuting these people. The ones who are lawyers can be disbarred. You know, ideally, we would still impeach Bush and Cheney and strip them of Secret Service and pensions and so forth. But the public doesn't even know that that can be done, which is why I talk about impeaching Jay Bybee.
All right, well, we're coming to the end of our set, David. We're just scratching the surface here. And just to comment on what you said, it seems like some of the public officials, if they just sort of admit their crimes to the media, then they just, there's no prosecutions. I mean, it's just strange stuff. We didn't have time to talk about more about stuff about the unitary executive and some of the details behind the wireless wiretapping. But I encourage everybody to read the book. It's Daybreak. And it's by David Swanson, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, Tuesday, October 13th. Go to Books A Million, 6591 South Tamiami Trail, right here in Sarasota at 2 o'clock. David, you're great. Keep up the good work. We really appreciate it.
You too. Thanks very much. Look forward to seeing you in person.
Excellent. All right. And again, I want to thank David Swanson for joining us. He is absolutely terrific.
Well, that's really good stuff. And I really would love to hear more about the, particularly about who in the Senate will pick up the leadership role after Kennedy.
And these views are not those of WSLR. It's board members, it's volunteers, it's VISTA volunteers, it's employees or anyone else, just of the person who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. These are uncensored views, and we want to thank Huffington Post and David Swanson, who's going to be here. We also want to thank our listeners, and also I'd like to thank Jason, who called in a late breaking news item for us. Now, my favorite shows on the WSLR and the news shows, of course, Jumping Mullet, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 6 to 7, featuring lots of great mullets, including Nancy, my favorite mullet, Ed, a new mullet, Derek, Cool Breeze, Dave, Stan, Joe Hendricks. And Joe Hendricks and I also have a show on Thursdays, which is Local Matters, featuring local news items, which are important here. And WSLR does have its fun drive coming up. Yeah, warn you. Get out your checkbooks and support independent radio like this, which is coming up. Larry's going to be sitting in the driver's seat for that fun drive, which is coming up in a couple weeks.
That'll be entertaining for all of us. Don't miss that.
This show is podcast. If you miss any of this show or previous shows, you can go to thesurrealnews.com and listen to our previous shows. Also, we're on live webcast on the internet at WSLR.org, which is a great place to go to see the announcements for other shows as well. We have Women's Matters and Sustainable Sarasota, lots of other great shows, Local Matters. We also have Democracy Now! From 5 to 6 every day on WSLR. We also are Pacifica Broadcasting. Stay tuned for Law and Disorder, which is coming up. Have a great day. This is WSLR 96.5 Low Power FM in Sarasota, Florida, your community radio station. Stay tuned for Law and Disorder.